This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Shane Atkinson was raised in a working-class white family in a changing 1970s South. He recalls his grandfather teaching him how to tie a noose. And in the same breath, he mentions his mother rolling up the windows when they drove past Klan members on the street. Shane spent his teenage years trying to grapple with the racism of his upbringing. He developed friendships with black classmates, fell in love with hip-hop, and formed an 80s-era rap group. Hip-hop introduced Shane to Islam, sending him down a path that led him to convert in his late 20s. Today, Shane is the Muslim chaplain at Elon University and the assistant imam at two historically black mosques in the Triangle. He was also the subject of the 2018 documentary Redneck Muslim. Shane, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Take us back to Jackson, Mississippi in 1970. Tell me about your family who raised you.
Well, my parents were the first generation of our family that weren't raised on farms. In college, I remember the professor asking us, how many of you grew up on farms? How many of your grandparents grew up on farms? And almost everyone's hand went up. How many of your parents grew up on farms? There were a few hands. And then how many of you were raised on farms? There were maybe one or two hands. So it was a lot of changes going on in that era in Mississippi. But my parents, we lived in a working-class neighborhood that the street we lived on one side was a black neighborhood, the other side was a white neighborhood, and then a trailer park at the end of that neighborhood. So looking back on it, there were a lot of challenges, and we were part of the, you know, working class white folk, but I didn't really understand that at the time until I got to middle school, and then I met a lot of white people from the other side of town. I didn't know there was another side of town, you know, so it's interesting looking back on this.
Tell me about your grandfather.
Well, again, he grew up, he was one of 10 children that picked cotton on a farm, and he ended up coming to Jackson, and he started making taxidermy supplies in the shed behind his house, and that grew into a huge mail order business where he was a distributor of taxidermy supplies, making the glass eyes and the plastic teeth, and he was a very hardworking, focused man. And you mentioned in the introduction about him showing me how to tie a noose. I only thought about this over the past few years. It kind of, I remembered that exchange, and then it kind of sunk in, like, that's kind of messed up. You know, that's a...
Well, do you remember thinking anything at the time that he did that? What was the context? How did that come about?
I think he was just in casual conversation over at his house. And, you know, being 11 years old, you know, and when I was a teenager, Eyes on the Prize was on PBS. So there was no context for what he was showing me. I didn't understand the backstory of race relations in Mississippi because I'd grown up going to school with black kids my whole life. The neighborhood I lived in, there were only a few kids, so we didn't have deep friendships because we just saw each other at school. But, yeah, he was explaining to me the physics, the mechanics of how this noose works, and then, like, the metaphysics of it, like the symbology of the number of loops. And he also mentioned when the authorities were looking for the missing civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi, everyone thought they were buried here, but we all knew they were buried over there. So this is all going over my head as an, like, 11-year-old kid, because he didn't tell me, take this and go harm people with it. But I wonder if that was maybe part of my legacy, that, you know, testing the water to hand this down to me, because this, like, I couldn't really relate to that. I couldn't really relate to taxidermy supplies and hunting because I didn't grow up in that environment like they did, you know.
Well, what were the explicit messages you were getting about race in your house as a kid?
Well, you know, my parents might let a racial slur slip out, like in traffic or something like that. I can remember being a small child and repeating what they said and them telling me, don't say that. But I think it's because, you know, Roots is on TV. People are starting to stand up for themselves. So I think there was an understanding that if you go and be openly racist, there could be some pushback. So they didn't tell me that it's wrong to say that word, but they said just don't say that word. They didn't really explain it, but looking back on it, and you know, going through different parts of town, they may say, okay, you need to lock the door, you need to do this. But really in high school, I think I was interested in, having closer friendships with people. And this is when someone told me, you know, based on the scripture in the Bible, those people are cursed and we have to stay separate from them.
So it seems like, it was modeled for you that there is an us and there is a them. You can comment on them, but maybe don't do so publicly. At what point did you, your own consciousness start to change that maybe this isn't how I want to be thinking about my community?
I think it's, you know, there's a concept in Islam called the fitra, where it's like your innate nature. It's like where human beings are born inclining toward good. They're born inclining to trying to understand how they got here and what put us here. So there's a field of study called moral injury, where it's related to PTSD, but people having PTSD type symptoms, mostly in the military, but when a person of authority forced them to go against their internal moral compass. So I think there was some of that going on, like internally, something didn't feel right about this my whole life. But definitely going to middle school, going to having more freedom to interact with people, I really just by example, I started meeting a lot of really nice people that were black and having some experiences with some white people that they weren't so nice people. So that really contradicted what I was being told. And for a second there, I was really questioning, like, is everyone in my family crazy or am I crazy? Because this is not adding up. And it turned out they were crazy, and they've mellowed out over the years a lot. But definitely hearing Malcolm X's name mentioned in hip-hop music and reading the autobiography of Malcolm X and seeing some of the way that Islamic scripture speaks about race, where it overtly says, it clearly says, a white person isn't better than a black person, and a black person's not better than a white person. It's the most righteous person is the best person. Or in the Quran, it speaks about we were made into different nations and tribes so that we would have the opportunity to get to know one another and to compete with each other and who can do the most good. So that's a very different framing of why we are diverse and how we could navigate that diversity, you know. That really resonated with me. It wasn't something, I need to have faith, blind faith in this. It's something I knew all along, but I didn't know that it had a name. You know.
So that you read Malcolm X in high school, but there was something that was opening or churning in you before that. And I think maybe your friend Mark played a role in that. Can you tell me a bit about that friendship and kind of where you were in your consciousness before you read Malcolm X?
Sure. I probably hadn't thought about it that much, to be honest with you. I mean, just going through life, I think... being white, you don't really see yourself as white necessarily. It's invisible, and you kind of judge the entire world by, well, my experience is the norm, and you judge other cultures by that. So I didn't really see that. I have a particular culture, but hanging out with Mark, I got to spend a lot of time with him, and then I got to see how common humans are. You know, we have so much more in common than we have different.
He was an African American friend you made at school.
Exactly. We were in a performing arts high school together. He was in a graphic arts department, and I was doing theater. So this is like 10th grade. But spending a lot of time with him and his, you know, just being around his mom, who was super sweet, and just seeing some of the disparities in my experience and his experience, even though we're both on the poorer side of town. Seeing that there's definitely some disparities in the income of our households and the dynamic of our household, and then reflecting on that, and just as much as the social commentary that was in this 80s conscious hip hop music was influencing me, definitely seeing the PBS series Eyes on the Prize, showing kind of the backstory to how we got in the situation had a big impact on me, because I was curious as to how we got here. True enough, people are doing harmful things to each other, but how do we arrive at this situation was always intriguing to me.
So you started a rap group. I know you had a mullet at the time. Tell us that story.
Not to discuss that. No, I mean, I think what's interesting about that is that we were, it was an older white guy who was DJing at the skating rink, and he was a break dancer, and but still had mullets. I mean, still did not commit cultural apostasy. Like, how can you be, I guess it's an earlier version of how do we be ourselves and then also express love for this art form that I think really gave people without a voice a way to express themselves, because you don't have to have a lot of money for piano lessons. You need a pencil and a paper to write poetry. And so it was just a very accessible way to express yourself. And especially, I guess, with the mashup of cultures that I found myself living in, a lot of that music was a mashup of taking from rock records. And definitely, it wasn't just a mullet. It was filas with a mullet. When filas, the white filas with the blue and red stripe were popular. So filas and a mullet and not being self-conscious about it.
So at this time, you were reading Malcolm X. You were beginning to think about...
It's a couple of years later.
Years later. Okay. Yeah. But your racial consciousness was developing, but it was still a while before you converted to Islam. So tell me about meeting a white Muslim and kind of where that was in your journey, your conversion journey, the first white Muslim that you met.
Yeah, I mean, most of the Muslims that I met at the time, because, you know, we might go to a concert and there's 10,000 people and there's like one white person there. It was a totally different time. So some of these people were involved with different Islamic groups, like maybe the Nation of Islam or the Moorish Science Temple. So in those groups, I'd never seen a white person. But actually, I was here in Carolina. I was at UNC. There was a Rumi Festival in 1999 that I flew up here. And we were at like the Carborough, the Art Center, and at Med Deli, and we were at all these cool places. And I was like, man, I really fit in a lot better here. It's way more diverse. This really fits. But one of the speakers at this conference was a white convert, where he converted in the 70s, named Imam Bilal Hyde. And he had studied in Sudan for a decade. And he was a chaplain at San Quentin Prison. And there were all these spiritual teachers. And a lot of them seemed, I don't know, shake, rattle, and roll, and shake and bake. And a lot of them seemed kind of impressed with themselves. But this man seemed like a very humble, down-to-earth person. And so just a five-minute conversation with him, with no performed piety on his part, it really made a huge impact on me. Just his presence, the state of his heart, really made a big impact on me as far as like the potential for what a person can be. And then also, here's a white guy. I knew theoretically you could be a white person and be Muslim, but I'd maybe seen one on like a VHS tape, you know, but I'd never met someone in person. So I went back home to Mississippi, and within a week I was at the mosque, and I accepted Islam because, you know, I'd probably been interested in Islam for 10 years before that. But as I would interact with different Muslim communities, it was such a cultural jump where maybe the masjid was predominantly folks from this part of the world or that part of the world. And there was so much culture intermingled with the faith that it was a huge learning curve to understand what was going on, or to feel comfortable, or to even communicate and have someone explain to me what was going on. But having someone who spoke my language, so to speak, was very beneficial. Even 5 minutes made a huge change for my life, you know.
Well, you'd had an earlier experience that I jumped over when you were in Sturgis, I believe, at a Walmart. And this was one of your first kind of experiences with a Muslim family celebrating Eid.
Right. And, you know, I wasn't Muslim, but like I was saying, a lot of people involved with different Islamic groups, maybe they weren't Orthodox Islam, but this was the era where people wore black medallions, black Africa medallions. So again, I'm not going to wear a black Africa medallion because I have a mullet and I have filas, but I made a medallion in a similar style with the cover of the autobiography of Malcolm X. It had Malcolm X's picture on it. So I met a Muslim family. Sturgis, Mississippi is a tiny town. I was working at a tannery. I was tanning deer hides all day long with a draw knife, if anyone knows what that is. It's not glamorous. And the big fun would be to drive to the Walmart and walk around. There's nothing to do compared to Jackson. It's very rural. But yeah, I met a Muslim family there, and they recognized Malcolm X, and they asked, are you Muslim? And I think that's the first time I really thought about it. And I said, yeah, I think I am Muslim. And I went to the Eid celebration, and to me at that time, that's a lot of people, men in dresses and speaking a different language. And so culturally, I don't really understand what I'm looking at, you know. So like I say, it was just a big cultural jump to understand, oh, this is the clothing emulating the Prophet Muhammad, or they're speaking Arabic, or they're speaking Urdu, and they're celebrating this. So I was just kind of thrown into that without any explanation. And I said, yeah, this is just too much for me to wrap my head around, you know.
How did people respond to you when you first converted? People in the Muslim community where you were?
I think people were pretty open. Again, it's an oddity. I'd never seen another white Muslim person in that community. So, and sometimes what will come up is people may wonder, are you an FBI agent? This seems like a running theme with, you know, some white converts get this. And then some white converts, they get put on a pedestal too. So again, about being able to see your whiteness and see your privilege. With some communities, maybe they treat you like a rock star when you didn't really do anything. And the black person that converted doesn't get any attention at all. So I think overall, people were very welcoming and open.
You were drawn in particular to black mosques. Can you talk about why that was and kind of what was going on in the black Muslim community at that point in which you converted that made that a space that was appropriate or welcoming for you?
Yeah, I guess just having the American experience in common, because where I was at, there was a predominantly black mosque and a predominantly like Indo-Pak Arab mosque. So I think I just had more in common, and I just understood culturally more what was going on at the black mosque. Because there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with wearing a robe or anything like that, but my context of what religious life is, it people are wearing suits going to church. So at the black mosque, people are dressed up like they're going to church. I mean, the men are wearing their nicest suits, and so I think it just registered. Even from just visually, like, oh, this is a religious place, and there's religious activities going on here. So it was less of a jump culturally to understand what was going on. The sermons would be more in English, and so I think it was more accessible to get the information that I was searching for.
But when you first converted, you did wear a full-length robe, right? And you, in some ways, say you kind of overperformed your Muslim identity. Can you talk about that period and why you did that?
Yeah, well, I think I'm still trying to figure that out. You know, part of it was meeting this imam from California and him making such a big impression on me that I want to be like him, right? But What really made the biggest impression on me was the state of his heart. So it's a lot easier. One of my teachers said, a goat can grow a better beard than you, and anyone can buy a hat. So we want to emulate these pious people that came before us, but what really is lived on is their character. So I was fumbling around. You know, I was by myself trying to figure all this out. And I think also at the time, there may have been some of this trying to figure out what to do with the guilt that I experienced as being part of a culture that abused other people. So one way people may handle this is...
You mean white Southern culture?
White Southern, exactly. So yeah. One way to do this is to commit cultural apostasy, to start dressing like you're from Pakistan or from identify with the people that are being abused. That's one way that some people will try to process this guilt that they feel. So, and I think part of it was just thumbing my nose at my family to a certain extent. I can remember going out to dinner with my mother one time, and I had a big green turban on, and there was no one else with a turban there, and there's no people of color there. But I think part of it to push back and kind of be rebellious at the same time. But
how did your family respond?
Not too good. I mean, but I think, you know, that's a phase of life where you're trying to establish your own boundaries, your own identity. So it's par for the course. But I see some people converting who, you know, it gets mixed up. It's not that we don't believe in the faith, but there's some other issues being worked through at the same time, and it can kind of get a little cloudy. But you know, over the years, my family really supported me being Muslim because I stopped acting so wild and crazy. You know, the big part of our tradition is to respect your family and not break ties with your family. And that was really problematic, as they would say racist things here or there. But the spiritual path really repaired my relationship with my family to the point that my grandmother, a few years before she passed away, she told me, you know, I wish that your mother and your brother would also become Muslims, you know. Mm. I guess she had tried Southern Baptists, and that wasn't sticking. So, but I think, you know, seeing that that there was some improvement in the character of people is, you know, really opens people up to accepting their family members that convert.
So you had been going through this process. You spent about 10 years reflecting and thinking about your spiritual journey. You converted to Islam, and then soon after, you were doing laundry at a laundromat, and something happened there that changed the rest of your life. Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, yeah, I've probably been Muslim for about a year. This was in Mississippi, and I had neighbors that were from Indonesia. We shared a house. Their father was doing his PhD at Jackson State University, and we were speaking about religion and philosophy, and he was telling me, what you're talking about sounds like the spiritual dimension of Islam, which it's sometimes referred to as Sufism. If anyone's read any Rumi poetry, then they're familiar with some of the teachings of Sufism. But so I really thought their family dynamic was beautiful. Like I say, Mississippi wasn't that diverse during that time, mostly black and white people, not like Chapel Hill. So, hey, I was at the laundromat and I saw this young lady, and I thought, she really looks like she's Indonesian. So I started talking to her, and we had a nice conversation, and then she left. And this was back before you could look someone up on Facebook, before you could, you know, not stalk someone on Facebook, but, you know.
Heavily Google them.
Heavily Google them. So I started going back to the laundromat every Saturday, hoping that I would run into her again. And it had just so happened that she was there because the washing machine where she lived broke down. So a couple of weeks later, I bump into her again, and we exchange numbers, and I trick her into marrying me. And then here we're, you know, five kids later, here we are.
A love story that starts at a laundromat.
Exactly, yeah.
So you were a biracial couple in Mississippi. What was that experience like?
Yeah. I haven't really thought about that much, you know, because we moved to North Carolina shortly. Like we were talking about getting married, and then things weren't moving forward. So I moved to North Carolina, and then shortly thereafter, she followed me up here, and we got married. And so we didn't spend a lot of time in Mississippi as a couple. Most of that time was here in North Carolina, where, you know, people didn't really seem to look twice, you know, in the triangle. Anyway.
Right. I want to talk about your professional career and how it was evolving. So we started you as a young kid with taxidermy happening in your back shed. Then you eventually were working at a tannery, and then you got into prosthetics. Tell me about how that happened and a bit about your prosthetics career.
Well, when I was my first couple of years in college, I was not sure what I was going to do, and I took this aptitude test back when the computers were really huge, and the results it spit it out was orthotics and prosthetics would be a perfect field for me. And at the time, there are just a few places in the country you could go study prosthetics and orthotics: Northwestern University, White Bear Lake, Minnesota, I believe. And so I thought, I don't know if I could do that. I'm not sure. And lo and behold, an opportunity opened up for me to go interview with a prosthetics company in town, where we had a family friend in common with the owner. And I got hired, and I was an apprentice by someone who had been in the field for 50 years. And so this is a perfect blend of, you know, I grew up around people making taxidermy supplies. So in their own right, they're sculptors and they're carvers, you know. So they're carving things and they're sculpting. So these are the skills you need to create a custom prosthetic for someone. So the artistic part of it was in my blood, and then the medical side of it I learned, and also I think the caring for people.
Yeah, there's a real human component to it.
That's a huge part of it. I mean, when someone has lost their limb, a lot of what you're providing for the person is emotional support as well. And I think learning about people going through traumatic experiences really started helping people come back from having strokes, learning to walk again, or building a brace to help straighten this child's spine so they wouldn't be in pain. So, yeah, it really started my first 10 years. I was doing that in Mississippi. And then after my trip to North Carolina, I thought, I really like North Carolina. It is the city of medicine. Why don't I just quit my job, load my car up, and drive up here and see what happens? And then wonders happened, really. I mean, stepping out there, partially wanting to be a part of a bigger, more dynamic Muslim community, which one of your previous guests, Daoud Haroun, was one of the people who had kind of ended up at this part of the country, who I thought, these are people whose Islam also includes a spiritual dimension. They're working on their character. I want to go be around people like this. So I stepped out there, and then I worked my way up. Another almost 10 years doing prosthetics and orthotics here, worked my way up to the clinical operations manager of a facility here, and was board certified doing prosthetics and orthotics as basically a physician's assistant, the equivalent in the field. And so when my wife and I got pregnant with our twins, everything took a different turn. We were having the ultrasound done, so it was our second pregnancy, and the technician looked kind of freaked out, and I thought I saw two babies on the screen facing each other. And they said, "Well, we need to have the doctor speak with you." And they told us that we were carrying conjoined twins, and they didn't expect the children to live very long. And it ended up that my daughters, Nadir and Husna, it was their birthday yesterday, actually. Mm-hmm. They came home with us for over a month before we did hospice care for them. But over the course of being in the hospital, I got introduced to a chaplain. Daryl Owens at UNC came and visited us. And I can't remember what he said exactly, but I think he listened, and he kind of helped create the space that I could voice what was going on in my heart and get it out. So that really made a big impression on me, and I started volunteering at Duke Regional at the time. I didn't really know what I was doing, and then later one of the three winners, Dia Barakat, who was murdered here in Chapel Hill, he invited me to come and volunteer at NC State as a chaplain. And my interaction with them at NC State really motivated me to go get some training because I didn't really know what I was doing. So I went right back to UNC and started researching a program called Clinical Pastoral Education. And it's a program where you can do an internship or you could do a year residency. The year residency is for folks who have like a master's level religious education. And there's actually this field called professional chaplaincy that I knew nothing about. So I was trying to figure out how can I transition from one field and into the other. And then I lost my job. And then I thought, well, this is the perfect invitation to apply for this program, which was just starting up. And within a month, I was studying chaplaincy at UNC, and then went on to be accepted into a residency back to back again, which doesn't happen generally. And so I was the first Muslim over there working in the chaplain's office.
As a chaplain at a hospital, you're bearing witness every day to people in some of the worst moments of their lives, emotionally distraught. You had recently had your own experience of that. How did you make sense of the grief of the people that you were experiencing and also take care of yourself with this recent loss?
I think I'm still trying to figure that out. You know, it's a huge amount of heavy lifting to be with people all day long who they're just finding out they have cancer, or they're holding their deceased child in their arms as you're talking to them. So I realized early on you need to try to plug into something bigger than you. However, that if it's whatever ultimate reality or truth, or you have to get out of just focusing on yourself to survive that. But it seems like maybe people study and go through these experiences because they're trying to learn how to deal with their own grief and their own pain. So I think I'm still processing all this stuff. It's they throw you in the deep end, and you know the second week you're there, you're on the floor providing care to people. But I think it teaches you a lot about yourself, where you can work through your own issues. So
how about your faith? How did Islam play a part in your work in the hospital and your counseling and with patients?
Well, you know, most of my patients were Christian or Jewish or atheist. So, you know, you're focusing on their faith, but definitely looking at it through the lens of my faith. I think spirituality across the board, it helps people make meaning out of what's coming toward them in their life. You know, like we could be driving through the Blue Ridge Mountain and see all these leaves fall into the ground, and one person just sees leaves, and another person reflects on just that, like, these leaves have fallen, I'm going to pass away. Like, mm-hmm. What am I doing with my life? Am I being the best version of myself? So it seems like spirituality kind of helps some folks extract meaning from the life around them. So definitely, as I moved through those rooms with those patients, there was a lot of meaning coming toward me. And I think people can really pick up on that state. Like the one of the older chaplains told us, be the calmest person in the room. And when you walk in there and you kind of toggle between what's going on, looking at the situation through the microscope and the telescope, like maybe having some inkling of maybe what the bigger picture is here, it could create a certain calm in the room that it could bring the whole mood of the room down. If you could go in there and look past what's going on the surface.
As all of this is happening, you are integrating yourselves into various Muslim spaces in the Triangle, meeting people and engaging in various relationships. And then you decide to start a Facebook group, which I guess first was called the Society of Islamic Rednecks. Tell me about the inspiration to create that Facebook group.
Well, there's a black American scholar named Dr. Sherman Jackson. And I was at a lecture, and he asked, who's taken Islam to the working class white people? And that really kind of stuck in my head. And one of Dr. Jackson's saying is, the greatest threat to religion in any society is not persecution, but rather apathy born of irrelevance. So initially I thought, well, how can I share about Islam with people from my background? Not trying to convert everybody, but just starting some type of dialogue. So I started this Facebook group, and then lo and behold, there are people all over the South, maybe like one convert, white convert in Alabama or Arkansas, that they thought, well, I thought I was the only one out there, and I was really struggling about how to integrate my past with being Muslim. And there's also another big influence, Will Campbell, who was a Baptist preacher who, in the 50s, he was helping, at some point helping Dr. King behind the scenes, and then also he would go do outreach to the Klan. But he has a saying that we all have a history until you come to terms with your history. You're not a full person. So trying to figure this out, I think part of this was me trying to make peace with my past, really, by creating this group. Not just about sharing, but later I realized this is me trying to integrate these different identities into one coherent person.
So you're trying to make sense of your history, your personal history as a Southerner, your family's history, your experience as a white man in the United States. How, I mean, this is such a particularly charged moment in our nation's history to be having conversations about whiteness. Can you talk about how you're received in doing this work, and whether, I guess, whether you think it's possible to extract white supremacy from white identity?
That's a big question. Well, I think there's so much good, like from my grandparents. And I think it's helpful for people to see that maybe they don't agree about where we're at as far as race relations in this country. It doesn't mean you have to throw away your entire identity, because I think really Islam gives us the space to, it's okay to love my heritage. There's space for that. There's space to, if I'm Irish, to eat corned beef and cabbage and wear green or whatever. But there's also this awareness that there's an underlying unity of humanity, that we're all one human family. So when it's built upon that foundation, there's space to be yourself. And I think it's important to, as you know, anytime something horrible happens regarding Muslims, more people convert. They go read about Islam and they see, oh, this is not what I thought it is, and this resonates with me. So it's not a matter of trying to convert people. People are constantly converting, but letting these people know you don't need to throw away your heritage, your history, your past. At most, you probably just need to make a few edits. And some of the edits I had to work on were male chauvinism and racism, but I didn't need to throw away everything that I took from my family, because a lot of it's beautiful. And we were screening the film in Tennessee, and they really got it in Middle Tennessee State, because we've shown the film all over. But because I was saying, like, even if there's a very racist person and they wouldn't want their daughter to marry a black man, they may still pull over and help a black person change their tire, you know. So most people are not 100% evil, 100% good. A lot of us are somewhere in the middle. And
but there's this question that someone poses to you in the documentary about kind of unlearning and letting go of things, letting go of your privilege. And how do you encourage people who are able to do certain things because they have white privilege to choose to walk away from that?
Well, you know, I think of the saying of Muhammad, where It talks about faith. Like, if you see injustice, change it with your hand. If you can't, speak out against it with your tongue. And if you can't do that, at least hate it in your heart. So, you know, we're all at different, we all have different aptitudes and talents, and we're in different positions of power to try to affect things. But we also, I think, need to forgive ourselves. I mean, I think a lot of people, they're riddled with guilt about things that they've done. So I think we need to forgive ourselves, try to make things right with people that we've injured, and then try to work to establish justice in whatever capacity that we can.
You're now working on a college campus. Can you talk about that space and the conversations about Islam that are happening in the younger generation that you're a part of?
Yeah, it's amazing that I ended up here, because everything kind of gelled and came together where I'm at a space where I'm providing support for Muslim students, providing education for students as they go through some bumpy times. And also, I get to interact with a lot of non-Muslim students. And I'm constantly, I have a stream of people coming in my office consulting with me about different projects they're working on, or I'm lecturing in different classes. So it's a mix of, I work at the Truett Center for Religious and Spiritual Life. So we do interfaith programming, and we support students really no matter what faith background they are. It's kind of a hub for people to come and explore different faith traditions, to deepen their own connection with the faith tradition they were raised in, if they choose to do so, and a place to really learn about each other, and kind of what I was getting to, not demonize each other. There's a verse in the Quran that talks about when we bump up against something that we see as evil, to take the high road, to respond with what's better, and then there may be some reconciliation between the parties. So trying to model, like, we can disagree and be civil. We don't, because I disagree with you, it doesn't mean that I throw my manners and my morals out the window. So this is a huge role we get to play as chaplains on the campus, is model what it looks like to dialogue with someone in a civil manner. As opposed to writing, when we write everyone off, it's really easy to think you've got it together and say the problem is those people, and then not really examine yourself. Do you have some hidden hate in your heart? You know, so it's a way to pass the buck sometimes, to just demonize people and let ourselves off the hook from being the better version of ourselves, you know.
You have three children now. Two of them are here watching in on this interview today. What kinds of conversations are you having at home about whiteness and southernness? What lessons do you want to impart on them?
That's a great question, and that's what chaplains say when they don't want to answer a question. But, one of my, you know, like you said, my kids are biracial, and one son kind of presents as white, and one presents as he looks Indonesian. So it's been a very different conversation for each of these kids, and I think it's evolving over time, depending on what's going on in the world, and having age-appropriate conversations with these kids. But just the other day, actually, my son's birthday party, thinking back to how I was raised, I had a birthday party one time when I was 11 or 12, and one of my friends brought along a black friend to the party, and my parents were pretty upset. We actually had a piñata outside, and my son had his birthday party, and it was a diverse group of kids, but one of his friends from school was on the playground nearby, and he was a black child, so I thought it kind of clicked. This is a replay of what happened, you know, decades ago, because we had a piñata outside. So I said, why don't you invite him over? So, and so now they become good friends. They get together, they play Beyblades and stuff. So, you know, when the moment presents itself, do what's just and do what's right. you know.
Shane Atkinson is the Muslim chaplain at Elon University and the associate imam in Durham and in Raleigh. Thank you so much, Shane.
Thank you.
You can find more about his work at our website, stateofthings.org. You can also sign up there for our newsletter to get a daily preview of our lineup. The State of Things is produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, and Paul Kiefer. Robin Copley is the technical director. Jenny Lawson engineered the show today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.